show! You have all made it to the dance. You have all made it.
Coming to you from the X-Access, it's John of All Trades with your host, John X.
Welcome to the John of All Trades podcast, episode 363. I'm your host, John X. Thank you for joining us. Glad to have you back once again. And man, what a feeling coming off that 10-year anniversary show with Kathy Sabin. She is a Denver treasure, and I appreciate everyone who has supported me throughout these 10 years. We're kicking off the 11th season, and we're doing it in style. Because going on right now in Fort Collins is the ACT Film Festival. It is put on by the Colorado State University Department of Communication Studies. That's right, the very same department from which I have 2 degrees. I have my bachelor's and I have my master's. So they're putting together this ACT Human Rights Film Festival, and I could not be prouder of them because they are putting together conversations and programming that matters. Case in point, this week's show, I've got Gabriel Francis Paz Goodenough. He is the director of The Body Politic, which follows Mayor Brandon Scott as he's elected mayor of Baltimore. Now, this happened in 2020, following the George Floyd murder and the subsequent protests, also in the thick of the pandemic. Dealing with Baltimore, which has the highest rate of gun violence and murders in the country. As Gabriel tells me, in the year that he cited that I can't pull off the top of my head, Baltimore had more total murders than New York City. So literally, a higher number of murders than New York City. New York City is like 17 times the population size of Baltimore. So clearly, this is a real problem. Mayor Scott is also a Baltimore native, grew up there, knows firsthand what it's like. So tries a different approach to tackle gun violence, tries to tackle it more like a public health crisis and study it from that angle. Because he knows that what they've done up to this point has not worked. So you've got to try something different. You've got to try and bring that rate down. How do we, as Gabriel says, end this disease of violence that we have in this country? Because we do. We are a very violent country. We were founded on violence. The world is a very violent place. But you'd hope at some point that we would evolve past that and become a less violent people. Now, in some ways that has happened, in other ways it hasn't. So this film tackles all of those issues. And I think it bears mention that as I record this, it is April 3rd when this show goes live. Less than a week ago, the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed. Again, another blow to Baltimore. So since I've been putting this show together, I've got Brandon Scott on the brain. And when the bridge collapsed, I saw some of the most racist people I've ever encountered in my life on social media, just dragging this guy and putting words in his mouth and exercising some of the most unconscionable rhetoric I have ever had the displeasure of seeing. What I found in watching this movie is Brandon Scott is a young leader. He's exciting. He's inspiring. He's trying something different. And man, what can you say? He's a young leader trying to get things done. I wish we had more people like that. So I was energized by this chat. Gabriel clearly has a lot of thoughts and opinions after working on this for as long as he has. This is a wide-ranging chat. We touch on a lot of subjects. And I don't necessarily have to agree with everything Gabriel says, and neither do you. But considering he spent 4 years creating, editing, and now publicizing a documentary about gun violence in this country, I think we owe it to him to at least listen. And that's why I'm proud to provide a forum here on this show. I'll just say this real quick. You can catch The Body Politic at the Lyric Theater in Fort Collins on Sunday, April 7th at 5:30 p.m. On social media, go to The Body Politic Film. That's Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And stay up with it there, because there will be an opportunity to view it virtually after it airs on Sunday. Making a documentary is tough. Making anything in this country is tough. And I'm proud to feature Gabriel Francis Paz Goodenough here on the show, as well as his film, The Body Politic. I will have links to everything about this movie down in the show notes. So if you're listening on iTunes, Spotify, Audible, Pandora, iHeartRadio, wherever you get your pods, you'll find it down in the show notes there. It's also available on the companion blog piece at johnofalltrades.us. So if you're interested in checking this out, check out the links. Now then, let's get to this week's show. Gabriel Francis Paz Goodenough is episode 363 of the John of All Trades podcast. He is the director of The Body Politic, and his episode starts right now.
Go become a union electrician or a plumber.
Yeah.
Or something. Don't get into film either.
Don't get into film. Don't get into podcasting either, because quite frankly,
Don't get into anything that the multinationals have their hands in. Yes.
No, because I started this show 10 years ago. Back then, it was a much different landscape, and there's no middle class of podcasting. People tell me, like, how do you become, you know, how do you build an audience for podcasting? And I go, be already famous.
No, that's what I was saying. Like, okay, yeah. Taylor Swift could do it
and mm-hmm.
make more money for herself and all the other people that make money with her. But, yeah, how can a roar? Like, yeah, what are your...
Like, I've listened to Dax Shepard's Armchair Expert podcast, and I go, he's doing my show, but he's famous, so he gets a higher quality of guest, yeah. right? And so it's like, at this point, the barriers to entry are just the same as they are everywhere else where they didn't used to be. You had to be early, which is why this show has any credibility at all.
Yeah.
So
are we already started, or are we starting?
Yeah, we're going. Cool. So that's perfect. So this is Gabriel Francis Paz Goodenough, which you have quite the handle, man.
Thank you.
It is a phenomenal handle. And you are the director of The Body Politic, which is at the ACT Film Festival in Fort Collins, my alma mater. And I had the privilege of watching it. It is spectacular, and it is great to meet you, man.
Thank you so much. Yeah, we are super excited to be up in Fort Collins. I think we're showing on Sunday evening. I don't remember the exact time, but yeah, I mean, it's been quite an amazing journey. This is my first feature documentary film, so it's all new to me. Oh wow, you got a cat, man.
Yeah, he somehow knows when I'm going to interview someone. And comes in and just announces his presence. So, I mean, this is cinema verite of podcasting. But
oh, wow. I thought that was his name for a second, was cinema verite.
That's an amazing name for a cat.
That's an amazing name.
That is a dope name for a cat. Who's this? That's cinema verite. Yeah. And that's
wow, that's awesome. Hey, you know what? Your viewership just probably went up by 1.5 million.
Well, listenership. I mean, we don't do any video here, but yeah.
That dude is loving the attention. Yeah.
He is enormous, first of all. He's like 15 pounds, and he's also 19 and a half years old.
Well, I mean, in the cat world, you want to be extra size, right?
Because totally.
All cats are like they look at you as a big cat, a plus size cat, and go like, wow, what a life. That is amazing.
Yeah, the plus size cat, the BBC, the big beautiful cat.
Big beautiful cat, yeah.
I like that. But The Body Politic covers the mayoral campaign and election, and then first few years in term for Mayor Brandon Scott of Baltimore. Baltimore is your hometown, yes?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I have only passed through there, but I know a few people from Baltimore, and the pride in Baltimore I find to be overwhelming, because the people who are from Baltimore have great affection for the city, yet culturally, if you're outside of Baltimore, Baltimore is frequently used as a punching bag. Can you talk to me about that tension of the pride of people who live there versus how other people from outside of Baltimore perceive it?
Yeah. You know, the film, just for everybody, is really about, it's about this American disease that we have with violence.
Yes.
Right. And it's about what are the ways that we can keep violence from infecting other people and continuing, right? And it's really looking at violence reduction as a public health issue. I think magically in the film, we do a good job showing how it works. But in my, you know, 50 years on this planet, that has been the crisis of Baltimore, mm-hmm. right? That's been the crisis of my city. You know, Baltimore is this, you know, post-industrial working class American city. You know, it's a St. Louis, it's a Detroit.
A Cleveland.
It's a Cleveland, you know, it's these cities that, you know, back in 100 plus years ago, they were the Silicon Valley, and they got crushed in the 20th century. And what happened is what happens when, you know, all of these things start to happen at once, be it poverty, be it people moving out of the metropolitan area, be it loss of jobs, be it whatever, right? And violence is something that sadly comes along with that. So I think we as a city, Baltimore, being on the East Coast around a bunch of really, you know, big heavyweight cities, you know, we've had a tough time, right? And we're very, very prideful. We're a very working class city. But sadly, you know, what we're famous for in a lot of ways is decay and death. I really wanted to make a film that really got beyond that. I wanted to make a film about what unmurder looks like, what unviolence looks like, and how all that works, and to really get into that, you know, and maybe even create a pathway for healing.
I like that. And one of the things that I was struck by most was the consistency in Mayor Scott's messaging about, look, I have lived here my entire life and I have seen the policies that have come before me and they're all the same. Yet Baltimore maintains its violent rate. We need to try something different. So that to me was very powerful because there are always institutional forces aligned against change for whatever reasons that they exist. So when you try something different, there's going to be resistance to that. And you captured that really beautifully. And I was inspired by his dedication to trying a different approach in the face of a lot of criticism and a murder rate and a violence rate that didn't fall right away. Can you tell me a little bit more about how you saw that unfold?
The big challenge is, I mean, the big enemy to this kind of change that we talk about in the film is, I think, the political system itself, mm-hmm. right? Because the political system is like this smoke and mirrors thing of, oh, everything's great in the world because of me, or everything's bad in the world is because of him or her.
Right.
The problem is that we've created, you know, violence is a 400-year-old problem in the United States.
This right? is a violent country. I mean, this is a country founded on violence. You think about the Revolutionary War, that's a very violent thing. And so that is in many ways baked into our DNA, which is to your point, I think.
What happened to the Native American population, everything, but it's not Absolutely. Just the United States. I mean, this is the history of humanity, right? It could be the Mongols, it could be Rome, it could be wherever. We are a violent colonizing species, sadly. And that's how we have created this westward migration on the planet. And we here in the United States are sort of the end of that westward migration. So the challenge in the film is you got a young guy that becomes mayor that everybody gives a lot of shit because he's young.
Mm-hmm.
And he grew up in probably one of the most police times in the United States. And again, this is not like a ragging on the police thing. Like basically what was happening in the 90s when I was becoming an adult was actually the Liberal Party, the Democrats were trying to seem tough. And they said they created these laws like the three strikes you're out and all this stuff. And they did mass arresting as a way to act tough so they could win elections. Right.
Right.
So what happened was in Baltimore in the early 2000s, there was a guy who was elected governor, but when he was mayor of Baltimore, he arrested 100,000 Baltimoreans in 1 year.
Jeez. Right?
So that's one in six Baltimoreans were arrested in a year. It actually had dramatic effect on violence reduction. I mean, it does. You can create a carceral state and arrest right. everybody, and probably you will liquidate violence, but you might create more violence because you'll probably be sending people to gulags and blah, blah, blah. But
right. And, so, and if you think about someone like Dostoevsky, who would say, you know, the quality of a civilization can be judged by viewing its prison population. Sure. Yeah. You're going to have less violence on the streets. But who wants to live in that kind of state? I don't have Dostoevsky, you know, quotes floating on the top of my head. I lifted that from a John Cusack line in Con Air. So just in the interest of being intellectually honest here, that's where that comes from. But I think it's still a useful frame for viewing that. Because to your point, yeah, okay, it's less violent, but my God, we're locking up one in six Baltimoreans?
One in six in you know, early 2000s were locked up, right? And we also are the most incarcerated first world, you know, developed country in the world. I mean, there's a lot of bad statistics to show that what we're doing doesn't work, right? So this young guy gets into office who grew up during this time of hyper-policing and also hyper-violence, right? You know, Baltimore, the year before I made the film, Baltimore City of 600,000 had more homicides than a city of 10 million, New York. Right.
Oh,
so we had numerically more homicides than a city that's 15 times our size.
Yeah.
Right. So this young guy gets into office. And what really catapults him into office is George Floyd being killed. It gets people out to vote. And but what Brandon wants to do is do long-term change to in terms of violence reduction, right? Which is get in the middle of violent situations and keep them from escalating and infecting other people and do all of these things. But to do that, it takes what government doesn't do really well, which is communication and coordination between different groups, right? So that's really what the film is, right? Because in Baltimore, the litmus test for if you're a good mayor is where this murder rate number is, right? Like right now, Brandon's actually running for reelection, and that number is in the paper. It's the total homicides and total non-fatal shootings, right? Wow. But we tried to really, in the film, look behind that. Like, why is this number consistently so difficult to lower, and why is it not working?
Yeah. What you say about coordination between bureaucracies, I think, is really fascinating, because the city has its own bureaucracy. The state then has its own. And then there are federal players here. And one of the things that I found most frustrating in the film, and from a narrative standpoint, is Governor Hogan consistently saying, you know, blaming Baltimore for the murder rate. And he, you know, Mayor Scott saying, I just meet with me. Okay. Just talk to me. Can I get a meeting with you? And that consistently not happening, because he can only do so much. His hands are tied. He has a hard limit on his budget, but some of the things are under the control of the governor's office. So getting a handle on that and getting to a place of coordination, especially when they come from very different political ideologies, is going to be a walk uphill. From where I sit, Governor Hogan seemed like a real dick in this movie. And I'm curious, over the course of making this film, did you have much or any interaction with him, and what was your sense of it?
Governor Hogan is no longer the governor of Maryland. Right now, Maryland has a new governor, Westmore, who's actually from Baltimore, who's actually, I don't know if the facts are right. I think he's the first black governor in the United States in the history of the country. I don't know. I think he's definitely the first black governor in Maryland. And okay. I think maybe the first in the United States. So, but right now, Governor Hogan is actually running for Senate, U.S. Senator. So I never had any interaction with Governor Hogan. Annapolis, which is the capital of Maryland, and Baltimore, although they're probably less than, 40 miles away, are very different places. And we never really were able to get access. We asked for access from a lot of people and got denied a bunch.
Sure.
So is he a dick? No, I mean, he's playing politics, right? And that's what I think super interesting about the film. Like, I didn't even realize it. Like, if you're a city, you get money from a few places. You get money from taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And you also get a lot of money from the state government, and you get a lot of money from the federal government. So imagine if you're a city, like, thankfully, Maryland is a pretty across the board, even politically, state.
Yeah.
But if you're a city like St. Louis, that's predominantly Democratic, in a state that's predominantly Republican, they are going to do probably, and it could be vice versa. Mm-hmm. It could be a different, it could be a Republican city and Democratic state, that the gains are so like childish that they're going to do everything they can do to not give you what you need. Right. So that's another. So you have a guy, Larry Hogan, blaming the mayors of Baltimore consistently. And Baltimore has had a rough track record blaming the mayors for all the violence and saying, hey, it's not me. I might be the most powerful political person in the state, and you might be the biggest city in the state, but I have nothing to do with this problem. And then you have the local mayor from a different political party saying, hey, there are things you control, like the juvenile justice system, like the state police, right? There's all of not just funding, right?
Yeah, you control the prisons, you control the parole board.
So, the kind of stuff Brandon's trying to do is trying to go to incarcerated individuals before they get out of prison to help them. So when they get out, they're not getting back into the world they were in, right? Because people are going home to the same places, same temptation, same everything. So in order to get access to those people in prison, you need the people that are in charge of the prisons to give you access. That's the governor. So that's what Brandon's trying to do. And this whole idea, this public health approach to gun violence, it's an idea that's been around for decades, right? It's not a brand new thing, and multiple cities have done it, and it's been successful, and it's also failed. And the reason why it's consistently failed is because the political system itself wants quick term, fast food, changes, right? Like, we want changes in 4 years. Like, imagine if somebody came to you and like, we're going to solve the, you know, the public education problem in the United States in the next 4 years, right? Or we're going to solve what happened in terms of the genocide of, you know, the Native American population or the Black population in the United States in the next 4 years. There's no way, right? These are institutional, generational problems that take a long time to change. Well, sorry to be so loquacious.
No. And even something like, hey, we're going to solve obesity in 4 years. You go, well, that is, there's a lot of issues tied up in that. So that just feels unreasonable. So to your point, after making this film and working on it for as long as you did, do you find yourself more optimistic or pessimistic about our American political institutions?
Wow. I do think people are good. And I think systems and bureaucracy are often not good. And I think bureaucracy, you know, I've traveled a lot around the world and I've been in a lot of countries. And what I've noticed is that you go to these countries, developing countries often, you know, when people on the outside say, you know, dysfunctional and, you know, the balance of poverty to people that are economically healthy is really poor. And these countries are hugely bureaucratic. You know, when I was in Colombia, South America, like you buy a stick of bubble gum, it's 5 pieces of paper, right? Like there's huge and huge amounts of bureaucracy, right? So the more I've learned and the more I've seen in making a film, as I've just understood that bureaucracy in a lot of ways is what's messing us up, right? Mm-hmm. The bullshittery of the system is what's messing us up. What Brandon is trying to do and what many people are trying to do is just bypass that and just do things that work, even if they, you know, take a long time. But there's all these other external forces, be it, you know, the media, entertainment industry, the news entertainment industry, all these things that have all these vested interests in spinning the truth, right? Or for their own political reasons. And I think that's, in a lot of ways, what Brandon's fighting against or other people like him are fighting against. But no, I still think people are great. I think systems often suck.
Well, one of the things I've heard as sort of a guiding axiom for a lot of activists is be kind with people, be ruthless with systems, which I think is a pretty good guiding philosophy, because if our systems are not working for us, then how do we embolden the people to change them and to have better systems under which we can all work and that are much more functional and much more humanitarian?
I think maybe I learned that in film too, is that like you turns you into a mercenary against bureaucracy, right? Yeah. Like bureaucracy is often a way that's used to keep people in power. Right. And we are a country, you know, the guys that established our country were breaking rules, right? They weren't following the British bureaucracy. Yeah. They were annihilating that bureaucracy. So was all these people that I think throughout history that we love and worship. So if all these people that are supposedly our heroes are going against, you know, bureaucracy, why is it such a revolutionary thing? Right. I don't know. It's but yeah, I try to stay positive. You know, I you know, it was, yeah, there's a huge bureaucracy to making a film too. And that's just as as the bureaucracy of politics.
Sure. Know? So yeah. Yeah. Well, so it's funny. I mean, I mentioned that as I watched this film, my inclination is to side with Mayor Scott, right? It's the story of him. It's kind of the Joseph Campbell hero's journey of Mayor Scott in trying to have less violence in the city of Baltimore. And so Larry Hogan is sort of a natural adversary there. And so my inclination is to think of him as a dick, right? Some of that has to do with the choices that you've made and some of the framing. But I did a little light research. And when it came to police reform, he either vetoed a lot of reforms and then was immediately overridden or would like basically everything he tried to do, the legislature is like, nope, that's not going to fly here. And so that's me sort of going on my own. But when I'm talking about artistic choices, I want to pivot slightly to a filmmaking question, which is, This documentary reminded me a little bit of, have you seen The Holly by Julian Rubinstein?
No, but I've wanted to because I know The Holly, I know that story, but I have not seen that film, and I've always been fascinated. I've watched the trailer, I know about it, and is it in a neighborhood in Denver?
Not far from where I'm actually sitting right now, okay. About like probably less than 2 miles from where I live.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, The Holly is notorious in Denver circles. And my question to you is, in that film, which is a great film, which I've seen, Julian is in it himself, like, a lot. And that follows kind of a documentary style that, you know, you think of some of the more famous documentaries. You've got Michael Moore, you've got Morgan Spurlock, where they are sort of the avatar for the audience in many ways as they guide through this film. You are not in this film at all. But you, as a Baltimore native, I'm curious, was there any inclination or did you have any sort of impulse to insert yourself into this narrative?
Wow. Great questions. You know, my own story of making the film, I think, is its own wild lineage. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think I felt comfortable with that. I definitely thought about it as a device. People told me to do it as a device. You know, I mean, we made this film during COVID.
Yeah.
COVID was a killer, right? Brandon Scott spent 85% of his time on Zoom. Zoom is a killer for storytelling.
Oh God, it's awful. That's why this is not a video podcast, man. Because
yeah, it's just an awful thing. I mean, computers and cell phones are really sort of awful things, right? And definitely for storytelling. So. We had so many obstacles in making this, COVID being a mega one. You know, I really started making this film because I wanted to make Baltimore's version of Street Fight, the Cory Booker documentary for the mayor of Newark, New Jersey. So I followed five different politicians, all super fascinating people. And then George Floyd happened. COVID happened before that. And we came to a conclusion that the most interesting thing, an important thing, rather, even more than interesting, was whoever won, we wanted to follow them for the first year. So I had everybody on board saying that, even though they all weren't really close with each other, they all said that. And so Brandon ended up winning. We ended up following Brandon. If you would have asked me when I started making this film on, you know, the September 19th of 2019 or September 13th, if I knew who or what the film was going to be about, I had no idea. You know, I hoped what it was going to be about, but the film, we ended up making two films in some ways. We made a whole election film, which is super dynamic because it's who's going to win. It's a great storytelling device and it's a fascinating story. But I think the more important story for Baltimore and the more important story for us as a nation that has an addiction to violence is the story that we told, but it was a much, much more difficult story to tell.
Well, I mean, it's a story with a lot of layers and very heavy tapestry. So, yeah. But I feel like you capture that really, really well. It was something that I mean, was engrossing to watch. It's 90 minutes that really just flies by.
Thank you.
Yeah, 100%. You mentioned making this film, it could be a story in itself. I have two questions about that. One, I'll start with perhaps the easier one. It looks amazing. Like visually, the film looks terrific. And I was looking at your crew and the awards that your crew has won. It's a real heavy hitter crew that you have working on this film. How did that crew come together?
John, who has sort of been like partnered on this with me from the very beginning, who is cinematographer on this and who shot it with me and also produced with me, you know, we sort of started it in the beginning and then we just, you know, slowly looked for people that would work with us, you know. You know,
oh, because of COVID?
COVID, it was everything, you know, like, I mean, we were hiring, you know, when you're hiring people in this industry, you know, I mean, imagine we probably have 40 people that worked on this film in different respects over 4 years. And people have kids, people have houses, people have rent, you know. So it's a huge responsibility to make sure these people are doing something and getting some kind of financial compensation, you know. So nobody worked on the film for free. other than me. Huh. And, you know, that I'm proud of that. But it's so hard. But I'm super proud of the people and the resumes and the work they did. I mean, so many people helped to put this thing together. But it's hard. You know, it was hard. We got lucky, you know. And for me, the hardest thing was just post-production, because I come from the production world. I come from the holding the camera world, not the editing the footage from the camera world. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's your background. On your resume, you know, it mentions working on films like A Beautiful Mind, where, you know, you're running and gunning, and then you had a medical diagnosis that really derailed that, and you pivoted. Can you talk through that?
And it's definitely one of the most, like, spiritual things that's ever happened to me, and it's one of my great, it's been probably the greatest lesson in my life in some ways. I was doing a film called 1,000 Cuts. I was co-producing it and shooting it for a very talented director who's based here in Baltimore, who's a Filipina-American, Ramona Diaz. That was an awesome film about Maria Ressa, who's a woman that won a Nobel Peace Prize. She was a very, very courageous journalist. She's still a courageous journalist in the Philippines. But during making that film, I was diagnosed with bone cancer, a really strange, weird type of cancer called chondrosarcoma.
How did you know you had that?
Oh, wow. I was in the emergency room for something totally unrelated, and they were like, you're good, you know, but there's this thing on your hip. You should get an MRI, you know, and then, you know, what a whole other bureaucracy, the medical complex. But
I don't mean to laugh. I only laugh from recognition, because I had 2 surgeries last year, both related to dealing with my sleep apnea. And thankfully, my wife works for a very big company that has terrific insurance, and so I sidestepped some of that. But even that, at, I would say, its most optimal kind of cadence, was still deeply, deeply annoying in terms of the bureaucracy that you have to navigate, because you get bills and you go, who the hell is this? And, like, what is this even for? And, you know, between third-party suppliers, sometimes the left hand doesn't know what the right's doing. So as far as having a freaky rare form of bone cancer, I can only imagine the level of complexity increases that much more.
Yeah, I mean, it was wild. I mean, the big takeaway I learned is, like, the more known your illness, the more money in it, and probably the more chance that you're going to be okay, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, it's an industry. And so I took, like, a 6-month journey of finding exactly what I had and what needed to be done, and what, you know, several doctors told me was that I needed the bottom of my hip removed. And the problem is that bone that they took was connected to 8 other muscles, my hamstrings, adductors, all of these muscles. So I ended up having a surgery at an amazing hospital in Texas called MD Anderson. And I had the bottom of my hip removed, and I had 8 muscles in my right leg removed. This was all while beginning the film.
Jeez.
And I mean, the first grant I applied to was on, you know, the night before my surgery. And, you know, I came out of the surgery, and a few months later, when I was in physical therapy, which lasted a year, I got a grant. And I was like, oh man, I guess I got to do this thing. So we had already shot a little, but it was sort of more, this is something that I've been playing around with since 2016 already, doing the selection film. And yeah, so, you know, I couldn't operate the camera, right? So I got my really good friend, John Benham, to come in and do that. And, you know, the type of work that I do, just like the name of your cat, is cinema verite, right? I do handheld documentary camera work. It's like the difference between jazz music and classical music, or jazz music and rock music, right? Like, you put me in a situation, you give me a camera, and I sort of go with the flow, and I help help the director create a story. That's what happened, you know. So I lost my income source. I lost my whole life. I haven't had income in 4 years. I'm disabled. Wow. You know, by, you know, it's like when people look at me, I think they think I'm fine, but as soon as I step on anything slippery or it's icy, if I don't have a cane, I'm, you know, people think I'm drunk. I just fall down.
Right.
So all of that was going with making this film. And then I learned how films work, and films are really, really expensive, even documentary films. What's even harder than how expensive they are is getting people to actually show your thing on their entity that is usually controlled by mega bureaucracies. And I had multiple people tell me I shouldn't do the film. I wasn't the right person to do the film. You know, it's been a whole, you know, salmon swimming upstream experience. And, you know, I joke with people, but it's not a joke. I think cancer in some ways, you know, I'm someone that is in remission and I'm very healthy now, but I think cancer in some ways was easier than making the film.
Huh.
Because in cancer, everybody's there with you saying, I love you, I support you, fuck cancer, whatever. And film, it's in often the opposite, right? Film, it's so many people making it difficult, just wanting money from all the stuff. I mean, there's an amazing group of people that helped me, but I am, it's like, what I compare it to is like, it's like the difference between basketball and polo. There's a reason why people all around the world play basketball and soccer, right? Mm-hmm. It's a really inexpensive sport. Polo, you need a horse. A horse is stable. You need all this horse stuff. Media is a polo, right? It is expensive as it is like the most expensive sport in the world. When you're a guy that lives in a little 1,000-foot row house in Baltimore,
yeah,
who, you know, drives a Toyota and like whatever, you know what I mean? Like, we are out there playing badminton with mega corporations, right? And they, be it film festivals, be it whatever, you are 100% gladiating against the most powerful, well-funded individuals, be it you're making a documentary, you've got a podcast, you're making a short film, or you're making a feature narrative. We are competing against the most well-heeled people on the planet who are vicious.
Oh, yeah.
And so, and cancer, my surgeon, my mom, my friends, my loved ones, everybody was like, yeah, we got you. Film was like getting going in the ring with like Mike Tyson in the, you know, early 90s and just getting whooped on every day. It still is. I mean, I'm still in it. We're still trying to put it out. It's a process.
Well, let me ask you. So are you wearing a Baltimore Orioles hat?
Oh, my God, yes.
Okay, perfect. Well, this is why baseball is always spiritually my favorite sport, because baseball is a sport built on failure, ultimately, yes, particularly hitting. You think about, I've used this example a lot lately, but you think about Ty Cobb, who, despite being a racist, just miserable piece of shit, and, you know, just a terrible, terrible person,
yeah,
he has the highest lifetime batting average of any player in the Hall of Fame, and his batting average is .366. That means out of 1,000 times, 634 times, he was not doing the thing that he is better at than anyone in the history of the sport. And you go, there's something kind of beautifully poetic about how baseball is a sport built on failure, and the way we measure success is in the few moments that we do, that we get it right, right? That we actually overcome the odds, because statistically, as a hitter, you are not going to hit very much when you get right down to it. So when you're describing documentary filmmaking, and when you're talking about film in general and working in media, the odds are so stacked against you that you have to take the victories when they come. And that, to me, is just such an expression of beauty that you can get something like this across the finish line. And for it to be good, I mean, you'll hear anyone who's worked on any movie, even a movie that sucks, even a movie that you hate. Like, let's, you know, let's say a big,
making the movie is a win.
Exactly.
No matter how good, the bad, the it's the greatest film ever is all doesn't. It's just the making, finishing and making is like, wow.
You can have dozens or hundreds of people all doing their best and they still put out a piece of shit. The thing is, like, that doesn't mean that they're untalented. That doesn't mean that their effort was wasted. It's just that making a film is that fucking hard.
It is. And you know what? And like, I'm the guy that's like the director, but man, it's really 1,000 choices. There were Mark Grieco, and there's so many people. Like, I say Mark's name because Mark was like the oracle that really showed me the story at the end of it, right? Who's a great filmmaker and helped in the post. And I mean, there's so many people that helped make this film, I think, work in the way that it worked. And it's not me. I'm just the guy that took most of the debt and was crazy enough and foolish enough and ornery enough to keep going. It is a brutal, brutal industry. I mean, I've been in it for 30 years, and before I was a working class guy. You know, I'm almost more working class now, but you know, meaning I was just a guy that carried stuff.
Yeah.
And it was hard then. And this is even harder. I mean, it is a brutal, brutal industry. And I think almost every day about quitting. And I don't even know if I'll do another film, you know, but it is a journey. It's a really, I mean, you do a podcast. I mean, it's the same thing where we are, we're fighting the good fight and it, but it's really, really hard. So when you have festivals like ACK come to you, which, and you look at ACK's lineup, and ACK is not a, it's an invite only festival.
Mm-hmm.
Every festival, I mean, there's not, like, if we show our film right now, we're showing at two other festivals, and I'm on the phone calling and emailing people to beg them to come to our film. Mm. Right? If I get 50 people in a theater of 130, that is a win, right?
Yeah.
It's so hard to get people to give you 90 minutes of their time. But I will tell you, the feeling of showing this story and this thing to people, the feeling of that when I'm there with Erica and the other folks in the film, there's just nothing like it. There's nothing like helping people, you know, feel. And it's just, it's a really, really amazing gift that you get. And that is the gift, you know, but everything, even getting those 50 people in a theater in some town where you know no one, with the help of a festival, is a battle. Everything.
100%. I think about the old ECW, right? Extreme Championship Wrestling out of Philadelphia. And I read an interview with, I think it was Devon Dudley, who said whether the Dudley boys were in front of 10 people in some bingo hall in Philly, or whether we're entering in front of 75,000 people at WrestleMania, there's someone in that audience who's never seen the Dudley boys before. And so we want them to walk away going, the Dudley boys gave us a show. Yeah. And it I want to tie it to a film that I saw not that long ago that I really liked, but The Menu with Ralph Fiennes and Anya Taylor-Joy. It's a terrific film. Have you seen it?
I haven't.
Okay.
Wow.
At one point, Ralph Fiennes, who plays the head chef, asks one of the characters, he recognizes them, and says, you're a shit shoveler, aren't you? There are those who serve and there are those who eat. I need to know which side you're on. And when I heard that, as someone who's made his living as a consultant, and as someone who, like you, has carried shit for my entire career, I identified with that line because it's like, yeah, the joy of service in what we do, because doing this show is hard, man. It's a time suck, and sometimes people don't fucking listen to it. So anytime anyone says to me, like, I listened to that show and I loved it, or I read this blog post you did and I loved it, I thought it was terrific. Dude, there's no high quite like that, like taking a piece of yourself in creation, putting it in front of someone else and having them consume it and go, yes, that meant something to me. It's huge. I agree with you 100%.
100%. And now, you know, I mean, you just gained one fan for your podcast today, and you do it one at a time. You know, I'll be listening to it now. I mean, but you do it one at a time. That's, you know,
you build it a brick at a time, man.
I mean, just like Instagram. Like, I'm a Gen Xer, man. I don't know how all that stuff worked. And like, I remember building from two Instagrams. The most frustrated you can ask my wife, right? And the most frustrated I've gotten making this film is social media. And putting ads on social media,
God,
it drives me crazy, especially since my film has a name, Politic, in it, right?
Yeah.
Social media thinks that we are a political campaign. It just, everything is a fight. But
dude, on that same note, fucking Facebook thinks I'm trying to hire people all the time because my show is like featuring people of different professions. It's like, would you like to create a job posting for this? I'm like, no, it's a goddamn podcast episode.
Like, show I'm a Gen Xer, that's my landline phone ringing right now. That's a telemarketer probably trying to get me to like get health insurance or something, which I can't get because I had cancer. Or I'm not health insurance, I'm sorry, life insurance.
Ah,
because they denied me, but it'll stop ringing in a second.
I can't even hear it, so don't even worry about it. But
what you say about, like, when people ask me my politics, I'm like, my politics are, I am pro worker. I'm pro earned income, right? I'm pro people at work, because what's happening right now in the society is there are people that are making money off of other people's labor, and there are people that are making labor, and it's getting harder and harder for the people that actually make shit.
Agreed.
To live. And that is what is going to hurt our country economically and in many ways entirely more than anything, right? If we were going to kill this beautiful thing called the middle class that we were lucky enough to have and that was created in the 20th century, then it'll be really hard. And those people need to make a living, you know? And I always wonder at a store, I was like, okay, you just consolidated this company and fired. Like, how do you get rid of all these people and still think people are going to buy shit? You know?
Agreed.
Like, I don't know how the whole thing works, but I will tell you, I will never clap louder for anybody than when somebody premieres their documentary or feature film. Cause like, I know how hard it is. It's insane. I mean, I literally had no idea how much work it is. Like, I have so much respect for any filmmaker, podcast creator, anything. It's so much work. It's amazing. And it's financially just depleting too in every way.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, you know, people will ask me, I'm thinking of starting a podcast. When do you think I can monetize it? And I go, you're not going to like my answer, because that answer is never. And that is true of the vast majority of every podcast you've ever heard. So I put it to you, in terms of making the film itself is a victory, is a success unto itself. That is unquestioned. But if I were to talk to you in a year or 5 years or pick a length of time, and this film did exactly what you hoped it did, what would that be?
You know, I've spent almost my entire career in this industry filming stuff that's about violence. You know, it's wild. Like, I just was looking back at, like, the first thing I worked on was Homicide: Life on the Streets, mm-hmm. and Sopranos, and I filmed in the Ukrainian war in the very, very beginning, not the recent iteration mm-hmm. of it, but when that plane was shot down on the, you know, in Eastern Ukraine, and like so much stuff, or even Maria Ressa, 1,000 Cuts, with, you know, the Duterte administration killing 60,000 people. I worked on First 48, right? Which really taught me storytelling. Sure. It's a reality show. And I think in some ways, one of the most noble ones, because it's nothing in that thing is manipulated, right? It's real. And I think, like, I'm so consumed by the history that we have in this country of violence, you know, and that we now are this country where we've all procreated in it. Everything's mixed, right? There's no way to undo all the stuff that's happened in this country or this world that's violent. So I think in some ways this film was like sort of an antidote for that, right? Of me really understanding violence. Like, when I hear what's happening in Gaza and Israel right now, I don't just think, like, people are so consumed by the people being killed now. I think of the people in 50 or 25 years that are going to hate somebody that's a different religion because their parents were killed by somebody that was a different religion, right? And that's what's happening in Baltimore now. There are people getting shot in Baltimore now that might be related to shootings that happened in the 1990s. Because when you shoot somebody or hurt somebody, they have people they love, and there's vengeance, and it escalates, right, in an exponential. And you can see how one act of violence or one major act of violence can totally become a wildfire, right? So if I had a hope for the film, it would just be this understanding that there really is a way to be nonviolent, right? There's a way that our organisms, of our bureaucratic organisms, can help us understand violence and be non. You know, I think that would be the greatest payment for this film, you know, second maybe to showing it to live human beings in person, which nothing compares to that. But, you know, I would love, you know, I mean, the White House right now has its first office of gun violence prevention ever. It's one of the great epidemics of this country, is how we use guns against each other, you know, and it's not anti-gun or pro-gun. It's just that we as human beings in this country have a difficult time being healthy with guns. I would love them to see it. You know, I would love people that are change makers to see it, because a public health approach to violence or gun violence does not sound sexy. It sounds complicated and boring, but it really is pretty genius. It's a pretty genius idea that people came up with, to look at violence as like an infectious disease, and it really works. And I think when we look at violence and we look at what's happening all over the world in terms of violence, you know, I mean, I remember when I was in Eastern Ukraine filming, people were talking about shit that happened in the 1400s. It's about stuff. It's like the infection of that. So that would be amazing to me. I've never thought that this thing is going to make money. You know, I was sort of maybe naive about the fact that it would maybe not leave me with debt. I don't know if that'll happen, but I really hope it helps people understand a little bit, and also understand about cities like Baltimore. And, you know, any place that's in the developing world, right, that the people there are smart people, and but the situations are super complex.
Well, so to your point, I mean, you're talking about the long tail of violence where, you know, it lingers and echoes for generations potentially. But your approach to thinking about violence or gun violence in particular as a public health issue reminds me of, say what you will about gun advocates, but they have prevented the CDC as studying this as a public health issue. They have successfully lobbied against that, because one of the things you'll hear from gun advocates is, you know, what are you going to do? Outlaw cars next? It's like, well, no, but the CDC did tackle car crashes as a public health issue and enacted a number of reforms in terms of insurance, in terms of seatbelts, in terms of the way you even bank roads. All of those things went into making cars much safer for drivers and for passengers. So things like airbags came as a result of that. So, but it came as a result of studying it as a public health issue, which we have not done in terms of gun violence, which is why one of the reasons that this film stands out is because in Baltimore, they are looking at it in that way and enacting policies reflective of that type of approach.
I mean, when you say cars, I mean, I'm not even talking about the carcinogens that come out of the tailpipes of cars, you know? Right. I mean, I think cars are probably the most murderous thing on the planet. And I'm a guy that loves cars. Like, I have a 1972 Chevy pickup truck. Like, I love cars. Sure. But cars are so dangerous, so unhealthy for human beings and a lot of the planet. And yeah, we have spent the century and 25 years or whatever the cars have been around trying to make cars safer.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to make but the problem with guns is the fact that human beings are not often mentally stable enough. When you have this thing in your hand that you instantly can make, like, I mean, imagine like your worst moment of road rage ever. If you had your Glock 16 sitting right on your lap, you might make a stupid decision. And you know what? I filmed probably 250 cases with Force 48, and I saw people making those stupid decisions. It's not a knife, it's not a baseball bat, it's a gun, and they work really well. And that's just that shooting, not thinking about all the fallout from that shooting, be it the medical stuff, be it the family members that are upset, be it the family members that want to hurt that other family member. You know, there's so much in it. So, you know, but it all really comes down to money. I mean, there's a ton of money made off of weapons. That's a big industry, be it, you know, 50 millimeter cannons or little 9 millimeter pistols, right? Like, it's a big, big industry. I mean, in Baltimore right now, how people get guns. I mean, Maryland was the first state that sort of outlawed this, but there's a company called Polymer 80, and you basically order the parts for your Glock or whatever gun you want online, and they send you the pieces, and you get a Dremel and a screwdriver, and you put the gun together.
Yep, ghost and guns.
That guns, and they're called ghost guns, but people think that like they're printing them on 3D printers. No, it's much easier than that. You order it, pieces, but here's the problem. The gun has no serial number. The parts have no serial number. So somebody is buying a gun, there's no way to track, and they're also about the almost exact same price as a gun. So people in the old days would be smuggling guns up from Virginia or all these places. It's easier to get guns. But now people just order them on, you know, not Amazon, but you order them online, and, you know, you'll have guys in houses in Baltimore putting guns together. Hmm. The hard thing to get in Baltimore is bullets, because nobody's like fabricating bullets. Just that simple fact is amazing. And it's also grotesque, you know?
Yes.
And the gun company, Polymer 80, Polymer 80 is saying we're selling parts. No, they sell. You go on their website, they're selling kits to build guns so people can use them and do whatever they want to do.
Without accountability is essentially what you're
doing. That's exactly. But like, imagine, okay, so every car doesn't have a license. Every car doesn't have safety restrictions. I mean, like, we got to just. Whatever we're doing is not working, and it's not an anti-gun thing. I mean, one of my most amazing lessons on guns was when I went to Alaska. Everybody up there had a gun, but they had guns because if you go for a hike up there, you could be killed by a grizzly bear or a moose.
Yeah, agreed. 100%. I have a friend who's a federal agent who had a gun issued to him. And we were asking him, you know, just as he sees it, as someone from law enforcement, the problem with guns, he said, he articulated similar to what you did, which is, he's like, it would be easier for me to just sell my gun directly to you right now in this hotel room than it would be for me to sell you my car. He's like, and this is a federally issued gun, and I could really just unload it to you for however much, you know, we agreed upon in terms of price. And that is a problem. And I thought that's a pretty solid distillation of what's going on here. And it's reflective of what you just said.
Yeah. And it's not about the Second Amendment, right? It's about making money. And we can still have guns, right? 100%. Ultimately, I think if the gun manufacturing industry had to pay all the medical bills for the people that are shot and not killed in this country, and the ammunition manufacturers, we should give guns to everybody. Let's give them to babies. Let's give them to everybody. But the gun industry has to pay for those medical bills for life for the people. I guarantee you that the gun industry would be like, whoa, 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 whoa. Right?
Yeah, let's change up the regulations. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not about limiting people's right to have guns, but why in the city of Baltimore that has one of the highest shooting rates in the country do I as a taxpayer have to pay inordinate amounts of taxes for people that get shot and have to continue with all the fallout of that? And the gun manufacturers get to make a ton of money. Well, yeah. Why don't they pay? Like, it's just like the nicotine stuff, right? Like,
right.
Hey, you're making money, you pay the fallout.
Or the opioid crisis more recently even.
100%.
So I could do this with you all day, literally, but we need to wrap up. So, Gabriel, where can people see this film? Where can they find it? Anything you want to plug, please do it now.
So the amazing folks at the ACT Film Festival have programmed our film, The Body Politic, as the closing night film, right? We're playing at Lyric in Fort Collins on Sunday, April 7th at 5:30. The film starts and we'll probably end it around 8:30-ish. There's a Q&A after it. The film's only 90 minutes long, but I think, you know, the really exciting, fulfilling part is that we'll have at least one, I think two of the members of the film there with me to talk about the film and their experience. So again, that's ACT Film Festival in Fort Collins at the Lyric, April 7th, Sunday, 5:30 p.m. If you want to learn more about our film, please, please go to social media. And it's The Body Politic Film, right? Make sure you put film. I think there's like a heavy metal band called The Body Politic. So that's Instagram, that's Facebook and Twitter. Also, our website, which we're updating, it looks a little homemade right now because it is homemade, is www.thebodypoliticfilm.com. Yeah, please, please follow us and please come see our film. We'll also be showing virtually after the festival or right at the end of the festival. We'll be showing virtually so you can also watch the film if you can't get up there to Fort Collins if you're located in Colorado.
Sweet. Here's what I'll do. I will put all that info in the companion blog piece that's on johnofalltrades.us. It'll also be in the show notes. So if you're listening on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Audible, wherever you get your pods, it'll be down in there. And while you're down there, hey, just give me a rating, give me a review. That always helps with the visibility of the show. But Gabriel Francis, pause good enough. This was just an absolute delight. I adored this film. And I wish you nothing but continued success with it.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure, and I will be listening to the podcast, John. Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for episode 363 of the John of All Trades podcast, featuring Gabriel Francis Paz Good Enough, which is one of the most amazing handles I think I've ever had on this show. He is the director of The Body Politic, a film I very much enjoyed, gave me lots to think about, and I think you'll enjoy it too. You heard me give you the plugs. Those are in the show notes. No matter what podcast platform you're listening on, you can find it there or johnofalltrades.us. Stay up with me on socials. It's easy enough. J-O-A-T pod is the handle. That's Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Pinterest, Instagram, Blue Sky, and Threads. I'm on some of those more than others. Check out Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram for the most action with John of All Trades. The John of All Trades podcast is a production of Deft Communications. Check out Deft on the web, DEFTCOM.US. I am a communications specialist, largely thanks to the 2 degrees that I have from Colorado State University, Department of Communication Studies. They did not pay me to say that. I just love the department, and I love what they're doing with the ACT Film Festival. But
More than 15 years, I've worked on any number of public outreach campaigns. I'm also a podcast producer. So in addition to this show, I produce six others. If you have an idea for a podcast, hit me up. The email is john@deftcom.us. DEFTCOM.US. I'm out of here for this week. I've got a really fun show coming for you next week. If you know me, you know I'm not going to go long without talking about punk rock. We've got some guys here in town doing a really cool DIY thing. If you're not busy on 419 or 420, this is going to be your show. So, I bid you adieu for now. Until I hear you again, say goodnight, Gracie.
That's good, Johnny.